Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name, your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg, and we have a wonderful guest tonight. Some of you may already be familiar with Dr. Calvi, Piero Calvi Parisetti. And for those of you who are not familiar with him, you're in for a treat. He's not only a friend of the foundation and a friend of the radio show, but he's a dear personal friend. So I always have a special interest in having him on. And he's joining us tonight. We're going to talk about a bunch of things, but he's going to tell us about an exciting new research project involving grief, and he'll be letting you know how you can participate in this study. You'll not only be fostering research, but you might be getting some great benefit from it as well. I will add that this show is being pre-recorded. It's actually going to air a week from now, which is much to Piero's enjoyment, as he doesn't have to stay up till 2 a.m. where he is in Scotland. So because it's pre-recorded, we won't be able to take any call-ins from the listeners tonight. Now, normally when I introduce Piero at conferences or webinars or retreats, I read his very extensive bio. And he's done a lot of things in his life. So when I say extensive, it's extensive. But I'm just going to give you a short version. Piero is a medical doctor who devoted much of his adult life to humanitarian work for the International Red Cross and then the United Nations. He's been a university professor. But somewhere along the way, he developed a keen interest in afterlife studies and grief, and he's now become a recognized scholar in both of these subjects. He's the author of many books, including Step into the Light, 21 Days into the Afterlife, Adventures in Psychical Research, Apparitions, and the Interactive Workbook, which he spent thousands of hours creating, and he later donated that workbook to Forever Family Foundation called Love Knows No Death. We're going to be talking more about that. I'll be mentioning his website throughout, but it's drparisetti.com, and the easiest way to remember is DR, like doctor, and then Paris, like the country, and then ETTI, Parisetti.com. So welcome, my dear friend.
Oh, thank you, Bob. You always embarrass me with this kind of introductions, and as I have done a couple of times in our actual in-person events, I say that you forgot to mention that I was the third person to walk on the moon on the space program, which is obviously a joke. But funnily enough, at one of the retreats, somebody took seriously. And after my talk, the person came to me and said, "Were you really the third person to walk on the moon?" I said, no. This was just to tone down this incredible introduction you gave me, Bob. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, you've done so many things that people will believe it. I didn't even get into some of the things that I know that people don't, like your musical career and your mountain climbing and your car racing and your shortwave radio expertise. And
I tell you. So let's keep the NASA stuff out, because Otherwise my credibility will suffer.
Okay. All right. So I mentioned in the introduction that let's get right to it. I mean, you are embarking upon a new research project that's connected to your PhD thesis. And people may be curious, why would a medical doctor be pursuing a PhD, especially in the realm of the stuff that we talk about. So can you address that? I mean, why at this point are you going for a PhD?
Simple, because my ego is gigantic and I want to be addressed as doctor, doctor of medicine and philosophy doctor. No, certainly not. You know, the genesis of this idea is a little complex, so you will bear with me, and I hope our listeners will bear with me as well. First of all, on a personal note, if I may, I understood that this incarnation of mine, this life of mine, is a life for studying, for understanding, for finding out, for seeing the relationships between ideas and things. I'm essentially a scholar, and I don't say that with any sort of pride or anything, but that's simply who I am. As somebody who very much likes learning and studying and understanding and finding out. I very much would like to have experiences, particularly in the parapsychology or you know, in the psychical research side, but so far they have been very few and far between, if any at all. Whilst time and time again, life seems to remind me that the books and the ideas and the knowledge and the thinking is what I am about. So this is sort of a short circuit way into why the PhD came about, or at least the proposal for a PhD. Now, why this particular subject, which I call applied psychical research? And, you know, to begin with, psychical research is a term that's gone a little bit out of fashion. And, you know, a century ago or a century and a half ago, with the creation of the Society for Psychical Research in the US, in the UK, and then the American Society for Psychical Research, anybody who dealt with these matters knew what psychical research was. Today, is the term is a little, as I said, out of fashion. So briefly, very briefly, psychical research includes both what today we call parapsychology, that is the study of human faculties which are yet not understood by conventional science, like, you know, telepathy, precognition, psychokinesis, remote viewing, all these things that go under the broad umbrella of the paranormal, and the study of evidence that points to the survival of human consciousness of bodily death. The idea that, in a way which we do not understand, significant elements of human personality, our mind, our consciousness, our being aware, and critically, our affections, the love we have for people, do survive the death of the physical body. And this seems like a preposterous sort of proposition, an unbelievable idea, until you start digging into the evidence. And this was my case. You know, I devoted out of who I am and my curiosity and my intellectual interest, that I started digging and dug and dug and dug and read, I'm fond of saying, to this day, in excess of 30,000 pages of literature. And I became a member of the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research in the UK, the International Association of Near-Death Studies in the US. I went to conferences, study days, and I even came to the US, to Alabama, to train personally with one of those people whom I regard as intellectual heroes, that Dr. Raymond Moody, whom maybe some listeners will remember, became a superstar in 1975 with his book Life After Life. That was the first time a health professional and a university lecturer spoke openly about near-death experiences. And so at the end of this rich and deep and life-transforming path of learning and exploration, I became convinced of two things, essentially. Number one is that what we call mind, our personality, our thoughts, our affections, is certainly closely related to, but also independent from, the activity of the brain. And this is, for somebody who was a Western-educated medical doctor, seems, again, preposterous, very off track. But this is the only conclusion an unbiased observer can draw if he or she truly engages with the evidence. And, you know, we have 150 years of parapsychology research, some 40 university departments, hundreds of you know, professional academic scientists have provided ample proof, undisputable proof, if you are objective and unbiased, of this fact that, you know, mind is more than the brain. Yes, there is a correlation, but obviously, as well, mind is more than the brain. And if you accept and understand that, then it is somehow less unbelievable to give in to the second conclusion I had to draw. And that is, as I said a moment ago, that in a way we do not yet understand, we don't die. Essentially, what we call ourselves, our mind, our personalities, go on living after the death of the physical body into a, you know, a non-material, non-physical dimension, which we call the spirit world, for lack of a better term. And these were, you know, it was not easy to reach these conclusions for somebody who grew up in a materialist dogma environment. That's what I was taught at university. That was that's what I used to teach myself at university for many years. But then, as you know, by truly engaging, studying, and critically challenging the evidence, at this stage, I can only draw these conclusions. Sorry, I'm taking a long way home, but believe me, I'm getting to the point.
Yeah.
besides and on top of being instinctively and as personality of an inclination, a scholar and a studious person, I am a medical doctor. And, you know, the main driver for me in life is to be of help of others, to others. And so as I was studying the evidence for life after life, early on I understood that what I was learning could be of great benefit for two categories of people. Number one, those who are in fear of death, either their own or the one of a loved one, or the death of a loved one, and the idea that death is not the end. There is an afterlife. We do go on living. Our consciousness and awareness and personality mysteriously seem to survive, can be a message of great hope for people who are in fear of death. And the second, and presumably much larger category, is the people who are in pain over the loss of a loved one. And obviously, and we'll come to that in a moment, if you think that death is final, if you think that the person you loved and you shared your life with, be it, you know, God forbid, a child or a spouse or a father, a mother, if you think they have ceased existing, they've just disappeared, you are in a lot more pain than if you have at least the hope, at least the idea that it might be surviving in another dimension, in another world. And that is my understanding of applied psychical research. That is the application of the research findings for the practical benefit of somebody. And the somebody in my case is people who are in fear of death, people who are in pain because of the death of a loved one. And so I started off with general psychical research, studying parapsychology, studying evidence for survival, and then I zoomed in particularly on what we can do with this knowledge and the results of research. I hope I made myself a little clear.
Well, absolutely. And you know, as you mentioned, you laid the basis for a belief in an afterlife, because you can't believe in an afterlife if you believe that we are our brains, because our brains are truly no more. So what could survive? You just told us what could survive. Our minds connect independently of a physical brain, and therefore life after death becomes somewhat logical when you come to believe that. So let's get into more of the research. I mean, I noticed that you added a page to your website that is looking for people who would like to participate, you know, in the current research. So let's talk about what that would be.
Absolutely. But before that, you know, because you've lived through the genesis of all this. So I'm telling you things that you know all too well. But I would like to take another 5 minutes, if I may, and engage our listeners in the history of this thing.
Yes.
Because once you understand the history, and it's not a very long history, and once you understand that, understanding the research project is a lot easier. So it was, I believe, 8 years ago that I had this idea to, all right, we start from the premise that the knowledge about evidence for survival can be useful for people who are in pain, for bereaved people. And I took that idea and made it, how could I say, practical. So what I did, I created an 8-hour video course, and that's, as you kindly said, I did really put in a lot of work in complete autonomy and isolation, but it was a project I really passionately believed in. And as if I were in my university classroom, we're looking at as many as 23 modules, short modules, maybe 20, 25, 30 minutes each. I lay out the evidence from about a dozen different fields of investigation that supports what I call a rational belief in the afterlife. And this is important that our friends who are listening understand that. You can believe in the afterlife for at least 3 orders of reasons. Number one, you're a religious person, and your religious tradition says that there is an afterlife. Different sort of the details may vary according to the different traditions, but that's not the point. Some people believe in an afterlife as a matter of faith. Absolutely fine. Other people believe in an afterlife because they had a direct experience of it. For instance, people who've had a near-death experience, people who've been clinically and legally dead for 15, 20, 25 minutes, have what they refer to as a hyperconscious experience, in which, and the bottom line is that they do visit briefly the afterlife and they come back. And for them, the afterlife is not a matter of belief, it's a matter of experience. They believe it because they have been there. It's like having been to Rome and having seen the Colosseum. You've seen it with your own eyes. You don't need to trust some guidebook, like, I don't know, a holy book or anything in our metaphor. You've been there. And so, fine. I mean, that's the second category for which a belief is granted. There's another category, and I believe to that, and I belong to that category, who need a rational belief. I am not, strictly speaking, I am very spiritual, but I'm not strictly speaking, a religious person. And because of my own personality and structure of thought, I'm not amenable to just believing a holy book based on the authority of that book. There's nothing I can do. That's who I am. So I need to look into evidence, empirical evidence, i.e. the facts. I look at the facts, and it is the facts that convince me that we survive physical death. I look at the facts, I study the facts, I critically challenge the facts, I consider alternative explanations, and I keep coming back to the same conclusion. As unbelievable as it is, my conclusion is that we do survive physical death. And I call that a rational belief in the afterlife. And so I thought that this rational belief, a belief based on reason and not on faith, can be fostered in other people if you expose them to the evidence. And so I produced this video course, laying out the evidence gathered for almost 200 years now by some of the finest scientific and intellectual minds in mankind, including as many as 5 Nobel Prize winners, incidentally. And I present this in a course of what I would call academic level, but very accessible for the lay person. I am told by users that this is very good. And this, together with that, I also produced a workbook based on cognitive behavior techniques, but now we don't need to expand on that. And this, as you very kindly mentioned, I donated this resource to the Forever Family Foundation, and this has been then sold for huge profit. And the Fan Bob I know is bought, his Maserati was paid through this course, because this an eight hour video course and the self-help workbook are sold for less than $20. That's the price of a pizza. And obviously I hope everybody gets, I was just joking there. So
it's a good thing you mentioned you were joking.
Quite a number of people wrote back to me, wrote back to the foundation, and they told us that this resource is indeed valuable. It helped them coming, either developing or reinforcing a rational belief in the fact that the person they've lost and they so much suffered about, it's not actually dead. It's not here anymore. It's not in the physical world anymore, but it does, he or she still exist in this strange reality we call the material world. That brings hope for possible reunion, and that validates the experience a lot of people have of contacts with this other reality. Oh, if only we could have these contacts at will. We cannot, unfortunately. This is frustrating. This is very difficult to understand. But this is a fact. Contacts between the world of the living and the world of the so-called death are haphazard, fleeting, strange, unpredictable, but they do exist. And many times people, bereaved persons who've lost a loved one, do have this kind of contacts, but then they question, was I dreaming? Was I hallucinating? Did I simply imagine that? And when these people engage with the evidence and they understand that this is a very common experience and it is supported by research in a number of fields, then their own experience is validated and they feel better. Now, here I'm eventually taking the issue home in a way. We have anecdotal evidence that this resource is helpful. And anecdotes are very important. Anecdotes are the stories people tell. And in this particular case, these are the emails that I and Bob at the Foundation receive quite regularly, I must say, from users of this resource telling, thank you, this has really helped me. And that makes us very happy, both myself as the creator of this resource and Bob and the other colleagues at the Foundation, because that's what the Foundation exists for, being of help to bereaved people. We could stop there, but I wouldn't, because I am a scholar at heart. I am curious at heart. And also, I would like to take my desire of being of help, my desire to be of help, to the next level. I want this thing formally evaluated. I want to know, in a scientific framework, and science, we know science is not perfect, right? Let's not get started with that. Science has a lot of failures, but by and large, the scientific method is the best, or at least the least bad way we have to learn about the world. And so I would like this resource to be scientifically evaluated. And this brings me to presenting a PhD research proposal to the University of Northampton. This happened only a month and a half ago, and I had very good, very positive feedback. I have all expectations and hope and reasons to believe that this will go through. I cannot sell the cow without, the cow's skin without having, with all respect, killed the cow. So I will not say now that this is a done deal, but it looks very, very good. I'm having the final interview with my prospect supervisors in 10 days' time, and after that, this will have the final green light. So this is what has brought all of us up to this point. Please tell me, Bob, if this has been clear, and then we moved to what could possibly be expected from prospect research participants.
Yeah, I think you laid it out beautifully. I think everybody has an idea, a pretty good idea of what you're trying to accomplish. So the next step would be for people to do what?
Right. Remember that this resource targets, is devoted to people who have had a significant loss. And we know that grief certainly ranks amongst the most distressing human experiences, if not the single most distressing. We're not making a sort of a chart of pain here, but still, anybody who's experienced this knows exactly what I'm talking about. We're talking about a very distressing experience. So when I am appealing, I'm calling for research participants, I put myself in the shoes of somebody who might have had a significant loss and might still be in severe pain over that loss. It is true that the method, in my original conception, is meant to use in combination. So people have to use the workbook and watch the videos. But this, I understand, you and I discussed this, our listeners should know that my dearest friend Bob visited Scotland just last week, and we were together here in my home where I'm speaking from. And amongst many other things, we spent quite some time debating and discussing these options. And my conclusion at the end was that I am proposing that research participants will only watch the videos. And anybody who feels he or she would like to give this a try would visit the website, and we'll give you, it's my website, drparizetti.com/research, drparizetti.com/research. contact me there, and then I will answer back, explaining what this is all about and what it is expected. But I mean, the bottom line is that a person who wants to be a volunteer participant is expected to spend about an hour to begin with answering questionnaires, because we need to know about existing beliefs about the afterlife, about the nature of the loss, the time elapsed from the loss, and evaluate scientifically through what we call Likert scales. It's a technical thing, but it's just questionnaires. We need to understand where the person is in his or her grief recovery process before watching the videos. So we take an assessment, and that takes about an hour. And then the person commits to watching the videos, which in total takes about 8 hours over a maximum period of 2 months. And at the end of the process, another hour of filling questionnaires. It is a commitment, I understand that, but by signing up to this, by participating into this research, people have, as you said, Bob, this might be beneficial for people themselves, but I cannot say that. I cannot expect that, because I'm the researcher. I have, what is called the null hypothesis. I have to assume that this does nothing. And then if it does, well, that's what we want to find out. So by signing up to this research, please keep in mind that you will be helping knowledge and understanding, and possibly finding out a good therapy, a good support to recovery for people who are grieving. We're looking at, all in all, a commitment of about 10 hours over a period of 2 months. Regardless of any effects which may or may not be there on level of grief, I believe that people would learn a lot of interesting things. Because, mind you, because I am interested in these things, but I think that, a lot of people are interested in finding out, the answers to the big question, what happens when we die? Is there an afterlife? Is a belief in life after life justifiable based on facts? Well, people may watch these videos and draw their own conclusions. And I'm not proselytizing, I'm not evangelizing in any way. I'm just presenting the evidence, presenting alternative explanations, and asking people to make their own judgment. So essentially, this is what expected from research participants.
Yeah, and I'll just reemphasize what you said. I mean, as any good researcher, Piero will be looking for participants who believe in an afterlife, as well as those who don't, because that's the only way that you could, measure the effectiveness. So, but regardless of your beliefs, if nothing else, you'll find the video modules very informative, and then you're left to your own opinions after you watch them. So again, what you would do is just there is a research tab if you went to his website, Dr. Dr. Parisetti, Paris with ETTI.com, and click on research, and if you fill out the basic information, you'll be contacted. You mentioned an interesting thing when you were speaking at the top of the show, and that there are different ways that people get to their belief in an afterlife, and one is purely by blind faith, and that is enough for many people. What I found over the years is that very often faith-based belief may not be as convincing or long-lasting as evidence-based belief. For some, that's not true. For some, it's perfectly fine. But I know for people like you and people like me we needed the evidence part of it to get to that point where we know that there's more to than physical life. And of course, the other key thing that you were speaking about was that the other pathway, besides the evidence and besides the faith, is if you have some sort of profound personal experience. And as you mentioned, that could come from an NDE. That could also come from a dream visitation or a profound after-death communication or an end-of-life experience and so forth. So there are many pathways to get there, and learning about the evidence is just one of them. You know, sometimes, as in my own case, learning about the evidence is what opened me up to receive my own communications, which I totally ignored for many years because I didn't think it was possible. Right? So, I mean, I'm sure you find you've reached the same conclusions, Piero, about that.
Absolutely, Bob. Indeed. Although I'm still waiting to see a ghost, to tell you this.
Yeah, well,
after all this studying and everything, I'm still waiting myself. But as I say, perhaps it's not for this time around. It's not for this incarnation. And I don't complain. I don't complain because I've learned so many stupendously interesting and wondrous things.
Yeah. Well, you know, based upon all of the evidence that you have been studying for so many years and the 30,000 pages that you've read, do you think that the body of afterlife evidence, let's put it in terms of the judicial system, you know, could the afterlife be proven beyond reasonable doubt in a court of law based upon the evidence that we have so far?
I answered this very pointed question, not with my own opinion, but with a very scholarly and thorough work carried out already 20 years ago by a lawyer in Australia, Victor Zammit.
Yeah.
Who did exactly that. He looked at the evidence, and it, you know, the evidence is a lot, but I understand that anybody who studies this looks at the same things. I mean, you know, the body of evidence is there. It's like, you know, a branch of science. And we all look at the same categories of evidence, you know, medium communication, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, reincarnation studies, and so on. So he looked at all that with the eye of a legal expert, of a professional lawyer. And he classified in his work, his book is A Lawyer and the Afterlife. I don't remember the precise title, but the thing is that he technically evaluates all the different elements of proof, of evidence, let's say, in light of the judicial proceedings to ascertain whether they would be enough for a jury to emit a verdict. And his conclusion is overwhelming. He says that even a fraction of what is available, not only in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality, in terms of the people, the credibility of the people who produce that, that would be enough for a jury to, you know, commit a person to death in countries where you know, the capital punishment exists. So the most dramatic decision about life and death of a defendant can be taken based on a fraction of the evidence we have available about life after life. And this is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, that's true. In Victor Zammit's book is, you know, A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife. So, and you're right, he did exactly that. So it's important, you know, you may learn about a particular discipline of research and try and dismiss it, but when you step back and look at all the evidence as a whole, you know, life after bodily death is the hypothesis that makes the most sense. You know, years ago, I found when, you know, in my own grief that the only time that I felt a little bit of comfort was when I was reading a book that talked about the afterlife and presented evidence in a logical fashion. And then a couple of years later, when you were giving one of your own talks, you mentioned bibliotherapy. So lest you think that I never learn anything from you, I resonated with that because I knew exactly what you were talking about. People do find comfort often in reading, no?
There's even more to that than that, Bob. And this is extraordinary. Our listeners may or may not know that the people who undergo a near-death experience, and again, in very, very short summary, near-death experiences happen in a number of, for a number of reasons, in a number of clinical conditions, but the best studied are the ones that happened following cardiac arrest. Why? Because we know exactly from the physiology point of view what happens when the heart stops beating. Heart stops beating, within 2 seconds, lights are out. Consciousness is out. And within about 10 to 15 seconds, the EEG, the electrical activity of the brain is out. And within 30 seconds, breathing stops. Now, I mean, I'm getting timing right, but let's say that at 30 seconds after the cardiac arrest, you have obviously no heartbeat, no consciousness, no breathing, no electrical activity of the brain. In even the deepest arc reflex, nervous reflexes, as we call them, like the gagging reflex, disappear. It means that there is no brain. End of story. And that's about after 30 to 40 seconds from the time the heart stops beating. So in those conditions, not only after a minute, but after, as I said, 10, 15, 20 minutes, people without a brain do have this extraordinary hyperconscious experiences and come back and tell about them. And we could go on and you know, discuss the fact that all these experiences are very, very similar across cultures, education, social status, spiritual traditions, epochs and countries and everything. Fine. But what the point I want to make here is that one of the very well-known findings of NDE, near-death experience research, is people who've had such an experience are permanently transformed. They show psychological and behavioral changes which are profound, far-reaching, and last forever. Their life after the experience is changed forever. They became a lot less materialistic. If they cared about money and possessions, they lose any interest about that, and they become interested in knowledge for its own sake. They become more generous, more compassionate, interested about the welfare of others. If they were strongly religious, they tend, that's interesting, they tend to lose their formal strict religious views and embrace a more comprehensive spirituality. And crucially, their fear of death is demolished entirely. Why? Because they've been there. They've had themselves the experience. They know there is an afterlife. They know the death of the body, that when the body stops functioning, mind keeps existing, because they've been there, they've experienced this. Now, the fact that these changes happen after an experience which was had when there was no brain is already extraordinary. But what is even more extraordinary, and from my standpoint, even more interesting, is that Dr. Kenneth Ring and his associates showed that such beneficial behavioral and psychological changes show up in people who did not have an NDE themselves, but they simply read about NDEs. The more they read, the more these beneficial changes showed up. So this, again, this is a slightly different aspect of bibliotherapy, because that shows that learning and looking at evidence, looking at research findings, can have measurable beneficial impact in terms of psychological well-being. And this is pretty much what I am about to do, what my entire project is all about. If just learning about one area of evidence can have these beneficial effects, imagine learning about around 12 different macro big areas of evidence. There's NDE, yes, but there's many others, and they all point in the same direction. And my hope is that attitudes and beliefs change. And let me throw in here, I know I always, you know, when you give me the floor, I never give it back, and I apologize. But it's important, I hope, and interesting for people to learn and understand these things. Medical and psychological research tells us that people who specifically believe in an afterlife fare better in terms of grief recovery. This is amazing. A general religious belief, which at times might be a little bit fuzzy, you know, if you ask, I'm partly Italian in origin, and my family was blandly, but still I grew up in a Christian Catholic environment. And I'm sure if I were to ask 10 different Christian people, and I'm not singling out anybody here, I'm just making an example, but if you ask 10 people of faith, of Christian faith, what happens after we die, you're likely to get 10 different answers, because the understanding and the interpretation of the teachings vary from person to person. That kind of slightly fuzzy, slightly, I wouldn't say confused, but, you know, variable kind of beliefs do not have a major impact. People who specifically believe that personality survives after death, and there is a possibility of reunion, and there's a possibility of contact between the living and the so-called death, do fare psychologically better. And these are hard data produced by science. And so my attitude and this research project is all about that. Can we change beliefs and attitudes concerning the afterlife? Not by asking people just to believe yet another. I'm not playing the guru. I'm not saying, oh, I know, you believe me. No, I'm asking people, watch the videos, learn about the evidence, challenge the evidence, draw your own conclusions, and we will see if attitudes and belief change, and we will see if these changes in attitude and belief have a positive impact on levels of grief. Over to you.
Yeah, and you know what you say makes perfect sense. You know, when I first read those peer-reviewed studies about grief, you know, my first reaction is, of course. I mean, it's logic. I mean, what could possibly give a grieving person, you know, more hope or comfort than the belief that their loved one still exists in some form? You know, I mean, I you kind of know what the study is going to show before the study was done, you know, as far, you know, from my perspective as a layperson. But you're right. Even, you know, people that I come across you know, in our work, and I talk to people who don't believe versus those who do, the ones that do believe appear to do much better in their bereavement, you know, journey than those who don't. I know that we're coming up against it on time. Dr. Parisetti's website is, it's DR for Dr. Parisetti, Paris, like Paris, and adding ETTI.com. So it's drparisetti.com. There's a link to research. Not only that, you could read more about his work, his therapy methods, and all the books that he's written. I would encourage you, and you can even pass that link around to friends, even if it's for informational purposes, or people, you may have acquaintances and friends who don't believe in an afterlife, that's fine too. You could use a good base of people to embark upon this important project. Piero, my friend, thank you so much for educating us all and for taking part in this new research. And we look forward to you coming back on down the road and telling us about what the research shows.
Educating is a little, you know, I don't feel that I'm educating, because that would put me on a pedestal or on a, no, I'm just sharing interesting and potentially useful things. And I love sharing my passion. So please, I've been asking you so many times already, because this is not the first time we talk in the interview things. Will you please have me and will I be eventually able to talk about the time when I walked on the moon?
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, and the people that believe that also believe that I got two Maseratis from the workbook.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Oh God.
Yes. Well, thanks again. I disagree. I mean, I think that you are educating people, and you have been for a long time, and we appreciate that very much. And good travels, my friend. I hope to see you again soon. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all the listeners for the time and interest. Thank you.
Okay. And that's it, folks. Thanks for joining us tonight. We'll see you next week. Have a good evening.